This is the Garden DC Podcast, the podcast about everything gardening in the Washington, D.C. and Mid-Atlantic region. I'm your host, Kathy Gents. I'm the editor of Washington Gardener Magazine, and we're aimed at gardening enthusiasts, people who grow everything from edibles to ornamentals, natives to exotics. If it grows in our area, that's what we talk about. Welcome to episode 190 of the Garden DC Podcast. In this episode, we talk all about dogwoods with George Waters, a horticulturist with the U.S. National Arboretum. The plant profile is on Laura Petalum, and we share what's going on in the garden, as well as some upcoming local gardening events in this week's What's New segment. We close out with the last word on Stalking My Local Nursery by Christy Page of Green Prints. This episode, we're joined by George Waters. He's a horticulturist with the U.S. National Arboretum. Welcome, George.
Well, thank you. Good to be here.
Great to have you. And so George and I are going to be talking all about dogwoods on this episode. But before we go into that, George, we'd like to ask all our guests at the Garden DC Podcast, were they born with chlorophyll in their veins and a green thumb?
Well, I have to say, I don't think I was really born with a green thumb, but seeing some of my neighbors trying to grow things in their yard kind of got me interested in trying to do the same thing. And so eventually I did start gardening probably around age 16, which is really about the same time I actually first came to the Arboretum. And so I think that probably helped to just, you know, push the whole gardening thing, you know, in me.
And what brought you to the Arboretum at age 16?
Well, I grew up pretty close to here in Northeast Washington near the Fort Totten Metro. And one of my friends said, you got to see this garden with these like fairy garden, these small trees, which was actually the Gotelli conifer collection, which surprisingly enough is where I'm working. One of the places I work now, along with the dogwood collection. So I thought, wow, that's was something. You know, to be coming to the same garden for all these years, it's a lot.
So you grew up in the D.C. area?
Yes, I did. Yeah. And fairly close to here. So we would often come here. My friends and I, we'd often come here. And, you know, it was such a nice place to hang out. We would be here a lot. And sometimes even, unfortunately, after the place closed, which is not a good experience to be locked in here. It's a little scary.
Yeah, I can imagine. I always make sure, you know, any park or public garden, you don't want to be locked in after dark.
But yeah, it's been a bit, I have to say, though, coming here and just seeing the, you know, the garden displays and whatnot over the years, and then, you know, starting to get into gardening, it was sort of like a synergistic thing where, you know, I'd come here and it would encourage me to do more gardening or more ornamental gardening. And you know, it's really, and so really, then I started working at Yes Organic, which is still around, when they had a restaurant down in Georgetown back in 1971, I guess. And so I started growing things like soybeans and wheat and corn and stuff like that in my garden just to start out. And, you know, which is kind of, then thinking back, it's kind of unusual stuff to be growing, you know, trying to grow wheat and small grains in your garden. But, you know, then from there, I just sort of jumped into the, you know, the whole ornamental and vegetable gardening thing, to which then it just took my life over.
And what about your current garden? What are you growing, and what are the conditions of that garden?
Well, I work in both the conifer collection and the dogwood collection here, which are my assigned gardens. Well, the dogwood collection, which is, you know, I have to say, which is the interview is about primarily, it's, you know, like a little area that was cut out of the woods over near the Anacostia River here at the Arboretum back in, I guess they started planning for it in the Women's National Farmer Garden Association, which is a group that had provided education and scholarships to women back starting in 1914. When women really traditionally couldn't get into colleges to learn things like how to run a farm or run a business. So they were doing really good work in making this all available to women. And they had this, in the group, they just had this inspiration to have this garden here, you know, and they started contacting the Arboretum director at the time. Might have been Ben Morris, I'm not sure. But they went through the whole thing of fundraising and planning and design work and everything like that. And by 1952, the Dogwood Collection opened to the public. And the garden, when it was first put in, the garden was to my opinion, it was not real organic in a way. You know, they had a lot of straight rows of stuff, and they even had a road running right down the middle of the Dogwood Collection, which,
oh, yikes.
To me, it's hard to believe you could have a road in that place. Mm-hmm. So that was removed years ago, and things have gotten much more organic and less straight lined. Mm-hmm. And so we've been trying to just, you know, get more things into the garden to sort of have it. When you enter the garden, it's a little bit more formal. As you go further into the garden, it gets a little bit closer to being like the natural woods as you get into it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's a lovely strolling garden, you would call it, very open. And then mm-hmm. with dedicated beds where you might have groupings of different types of dogwoods together. And then, of course, you have the Gotelli collection, which are mainly dwarf conifers. In that same area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the gardens are really close together, only separated by a little strip of wood. So, you know, it's pretty convenient. Sometimes I just run through the woods to get from one garden to the other if I don't want to jump in my vehicle. But the Gotelli collection, which is really like my first introduction to the Arboretum, is a pretty amazing garden. It was one of the first large public gardens, space dedicated to dwarf conifers. And It still is, you know, people who are in the conifer world and whatnot, it's still sort of a famous garden to them. And we've had, we actually had the American Conifer Society down here for a regional meeting in 2018 in the fall. And it was great. You know, the people really loved it. And it's a mature garden. So, you know, you can really see the effect of, you know, some of these trees that people consider small. They're large, you know, now after growing in the ground for so many years. I mean, the garden is, let me see, the garden was put in 62. So the garden is 72 years old, possible. 62 years old, 62. So a lot of the plants are pretty mature, and you really get the effect, you know, of this large texture and color thing. And part of the whole, design was, to me, is just excellent in the garden, where you have a lot of color combinations, you know, they keep it very lively, you know, so we have a lot of, you know, contrasting things like, you know, blue spruces, mm-hmm. blue foliage, gold foliage, green foliage, you know, give a nice variety. And then within the garden also, there's really a large collection of Japanese maples and also every crepe myrtle that the Arboretum has introduced. And then lately we've actually started adding a lot more crepe myrtles developed by other groups, just to sort of show the diversity of crepe myrtles and having all that stuff, you know, having deciduous plants in the garden really makes a big difference to, you know, keeps it dynamic. If it was all conifers, I think it might be a little bit, a little stiff you know, so this really makes the garden really, really alive. And I love it. It's one of my favorite places in the world. And, I guess I've been there long enough that it should be one of my favorite places in the world.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say that my first experience there was on probably the hottest day of the summer one year, and it was not a pleasant experience. bring a summer parasol or sun parasol or something and wear your sunscreen, because it is very exposed out there. But also your other impression of it, you know, you're going in what you think is going to be a dwarf conifer collection, and many of them are over your head, and that just shows you the relative size of dwarfs.
Yeah, it's really true. We've gone, and you know, I have to say, when we were at regional meeting of, or some of these meetings that the American Conifer Society has in 2018, they had their annual meeting in North Carolina in Charlotte. And so, we, you know, when all these meetings, you go tour people's gardens, you know, people's personal gardens, and also, you know, you move, we go to institutions and also nurseries in the area. But, you know, one thing that was funny is to see some of the plants that we have in our garden that, you know, they're, you know, they'd be 30 feet tall or whatnot, you know, and you go and see them in other people's gardens and they're like 3 feet tall. They've been there for 10 years, or 3 feet tall or 5 feet tall. But the scale is really quite something to see, the, you know, how these plants just keep growing. Although, albeit much slower than the straight species, and keeping it all, you know, fairly, you know, we're able to manage it and keep things sort of in proportion, you know, through judicious pruning and sometimes removal of some plants and, you know, repropagating them and bringing back younger plants of the same type. And we also try, one of the things we try to do in this garden network really is trying to preserve the original germplasm. So we when plants sort of get a little tired or old, we start propagating them to end up with, you know, new specimens that we can replace some of the older damaged or, you know, diseased or whatnot specimens. And, you know, after some of our bad snowstorms we've had, like 22 and 2010, where we've lost a lot of mature specimens, it really comes in, you know, handy to, if we want to replace it with the exact same plant, this gives us that opportunity to maintain the original plantings.
Good to know. So back to you and your experiences at the Arboretum. How many years have you been with the Arboretum now?
Next week, on the 17th, I will have been at the Arboretum for 29 years.
Wow.
Which I didn't think I'd be working anywhere for 29 years. But now I love working here. It's just a nice environment with great people, which makes it really great to work in. But when I first started here in 95, I started in the azalea collection. And I was there for about 3 years. It was great since I loved the azaleas. It was like a dream come true. That from there, I moved over to the herb garden for a small amount of time, which I always wanted to work there also. So I got that opportunity. And from there, I moved over to the Asian collection, where I worked for about 6 or 7 years. And I thought that was like the thing, you know, that was like, you know, a great garden, you know. And so after a little while there, I was reassigned to the conifer and dogwood collections. And it's funny, because working in the Asian collection, I'd been on the Japanese sort of side of the collection, which is Japanese woodland, and the camellia collection, which is abuts the dogwood collection. So I'd often look down there and go, wow, there's a lot of dogwoods and a lot of grass, you know, a lot of turf. Some of the gardens have no turf, like the Asian collection has almost no turf, but a big part of the dogwood collection is large expansive turf, which, you know, makes it kind of inviting to people. But yeah, I wasn't that into dogwoods, to tell the truth, before I started there. But once you're put in the position, you know, then I, you know, you study them and whatnot and become quite enthusiastic. So now I'm fairly fanatical about dogwoods also. So I don't know if there's going to be another class of plants, you know, but, you know, it's enjoyable to actually have, you know, two different gardens to work in that are, and they're both of them are quite different from each other. You know, the Catelli collection is very formal and, you know, very organized in a way, you know, and the dogwood collection is, but, you know, quite a bit different. It's open, and it's much more informal, an informal type garden. But the setting of it, I think, is particularly nice, because you have the Anacostia River to the east, which is, you know, the great water feature. You can see it from anywhere in the garden, so you get this great feeling. And looking to the west, you see Mount Hamilton, which is the azalea collection. And so you really get this nice feel that you're somewhere far away from Washington. You just really don't feel like you're in the city, because you barely see it. You can hear it, but you don't really see it. And so it's a great illusion. It really reminds me of being out in the country, like out in West Virginia. I have a place in West Virginia. And I mean, there's many times I'm out there that I really almost feel like I'm that far away from Washington.
Mm-hmm. I hear
that's a good feeling.
I hear a lot of listeners, saying the same thing, that, you know, it's their escape from the city. The National Arboretum, for listeners who aren't familiar with it, who aren't maybe in the Washington, D.C. area, it is literally, I would think, a mile as the crow flies from the U.S. Capitol. It really sits down in northeast D.C. inside the city, but you do have one of the highest points in the city. You are lined, again, with the river on one side, and across the river is Kenilworth Aquatic Gardens and Kenilworth Park, so you get a nice green view that direction. And the other side is very super busy New York Avenue, Route 50. And that's like the complete opposite. But yeah, you do feel completely insulated in there and like you're in your own world.
Yeah, it makes a big difference. You know, I can tell it whenever there's, you know, a lot of people come there, and sometimes you can just get, you know, a nice a sense of peace just by being there for a small amount of time. I see a lot of people who just come, you know, and just some people will sit there and just meditate for a while or just enjoy the view. But, you know, you can just tell people come and they're quite relaxed, you know, after they're there you know, happy that the place is really there. When we were having, you know, bad, you know, let's say serious events, like when we had 9/11. So, you know, everybody was very wound up and uptight. Our visitorship went up dramatically. I would say it probably went up 2 or 3 times what it normally is. And there'd just be so many people that would just, you know, you could tell they were coming there just to stop thinking about what was going on and, you know, outside, you know, with you know, the terrorist attack and everything like that. So the place really does provide people, a lot of people with, you know, good sense of peace of mind. And, you know, people come up to me all the time at the site and they tell us, you know, how much they enjoy being there. And, you know, they'll often come up and just thank us for working in the garden, which, you know, makes a gardener feel great. Mm-hmm. That people are really appreciating the work we do to try to have a you know, a beautiful space.
Mm-hmm. And we should let listeners know that it's part of the USDA under the federal government. It is free and open, I think, almost every day of the year.
Yeah, it's open every day of the year except for Christmas. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you couldn't ask for a better thing, you know, you know, for the public than that. And I have to say, even for myself, when I've been going through difficult times, you know, I come to the Arboretum and, you know, it's the same thing I think that's happening to other people. You're just surrounded by, you know, green and, you know, a peaceful environment. And it really makes a big difference in your state of mind.
I will say, let's turn back now to the Dogwood Collection. And it's been there, I think we were saying 1952, so over 70 years now. And I did not know, George, until I was researching this for our episode, that it has a formal name, the Miss Frances King Dogwood Garden.
Yes. And so Frances King, she was one of the first people, first president of the Women's National Farm and Garden Association. And so honoring her, the garden in her name, as an honor to her, tribute to her. And a lot of the things, like there's an overlook, you know, and different parts of the garden, things are dedicated or, you know, they honor different past presidents of the group, the Women's National Farm and Garden Association group. And so it's nice, you know, we have trees dedicated to them. And, you know, since it's really, and when they come down, they tell us, you know, they're happy that we're taking care of their garden for them. Mm-hmm. So I thought I was working for the government, but actually I think in that garden, I'm working for, you know, the Women's National Farm and Garden Association, but it's a great group. And, you know, they help us, you know, with the salaries of our interns and also for, you know, financial assistance for maintaining the garden, mm-hmm. which, you know, it's not cheap, you know, things pretty expensive, you know, repairing things, irrigation and, you know, just the infrastructure of the garden. It's pretty pricey. So fortunately, the garden also, the government, I should say, it helps the government at the expenses of maintaining the garden.
Good to hear. And I'm glad to hear they're still active with the garden.
Yeah. Yeah. Now they, unfortunately, I have to say, they have a place up in Ambler, Pennsylvania, where they have a beautiful garden and they have their headquarters with a lot of historical documentation about the group. Unfortunately, I believe it was in 2022, they had a very strong tornado came through, unfortunately came right through the garden, and it was just, you know, tremendous damage to the garden. And it, you know, things like that with a small group, it's hard, it's very expensive and difficult to, you know, rebuild, you know, it takes a lot of money. So, you know, I'm hoping it's slowly but surely they're getting it back together and restoring the gardens back to, you know, what it was like. But the tornado was so strong, trees, large mature trees were just snapped like matchsticks. Mm-hmm. You know, that's, I'm sure it was heartbreaking to them, and certainly it was a shock to me. I didn't even know about it until they told me it had happened. I hadn't heard about it prior to that.
Yeah, I have a couple of friends up at Ambler, at the university or school there and who live around that area. And they described it similar to what we had experienced during the derecho, you know, that trees were just kind of sheared off and the suddenness of it is just insane. But yeah, a lot of cleanup and a lot of reinvestment in planting and replacing those trees lost.
Yeah, it's a lot. It really is, you know. I mean, even for us, when we have something like that happen, it's a struggle. You know, we don't have all the resources we'd like to have. You know, this is gardens, I think, are pretty low on the priority list of the government. And we may be one of the only gardens that the USDA administers. There may mm-hmm. be one other place that's sort of garden-like, but I think the Arboretum is pretty unique.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a national treasure that everyone should support, and write your local congressman and senator for
Absolutely.
Funding. Yep. And so you also have a friends group, and we'll digress a little bit to talk about that and then circle back to Dogwoods. So the Friends of the National Arboretum, you can become a member of that and a supporter of the National Arboretum, but they also have coming up soon as we're recording this, their annual fundraiser, which is the Garden Fair, which I have a booth and table at. And I know, George, you and the staff at the U.S. National Arboretum are also involved in the Garden Fair.
Yeah, it's a great thing. I mean, people, you know, we have a lot of vendors selling all different types of crafts and things like that. And a lot of just an excellent selection of plants that the members of FONA acquire for us. And a lot of them are acquired at the Mid-Atlantic Trade Show that's up in Baltimore in January. So a lot of the things, they'll often buy all the plants that some of these nurseries bring as a display. And we'll keep them down here in our greenhouse until the appropriate time, which is, you know, 2 weeks from now, and then get them out there to sell. And sometimes there's just some exceptional, amazing plant material that comes out of that, you know, because people are trying to show off the best things they have in their nursery. So going to the Mad Show is an eye opener. It might knock you out because there's a whole lot to take in. But if you're into plants and gardening and growing stuff, it really is an eye opener to see all the different products and plants and services that are available. And it's great. You know, and a lot of times what's great about it is we go up there. We've been going up there for like 20, you know, 25 years or something. Like I have anyway myself. And what's nice is that you often run into people in the industry that you've met before. And then often people you work with that are working at different gardens and they're just at the trade show themselves, just looking around. So it's a good time to catch up with people. And yeah, I look forward to it every year.
Mm-hmm. And the Arboretum has its own booth at Mance that I visit every year. And they're usually talking about some of the new plant introductions and research they're doing there.
Yeah, and some of the research. So a lot of it, yeah. And so it's nice that we've had in Beltsville, part of the Arboretum that's in Beltsville, they've been doing a lot of virology studies and trying to get a quick, I think that they have, it's already out, but a quick analysis test, like an ELISA test, to let you know if you've got viruses in certain plants, which is great for if you're propagating and you want to make sure you've got healthy stock and you don't want to go through, you know, something more elaborate. This gives you a real quick test. And it's probably saved a lot of people a lot of money and a lot of time, you know, by not growing, you know, unhealthy plants and then finding out later on that, you know, you can't sell them or that you're going to have some big problem in the greenhouse. But the Arboretum is constantly trying to develop new plants. Right now, there's really a lot of cherries, ornamental cherries. In the past, the Arboretum's released a lot of things. I mean, just a tremendous number of plants, like most of the crepe myrtles that people have in their yards, at least until recently, were of Arboretum provenance. And you know, they made this fantastic breakthrough back years back where they actually acquired this variety of crepe myrtle from Japan that really hadn't been in the breeding programs, that introduces this beautiful bark and powdery mildew resistance. And that was a game changer. And it really made it so crepe myrtles became so much more popular. To now they're everywhere. And but Natchez, which is one of the ones that they released, I think it was actually released in 1978, that's really become one of the standards. What people, you know, think about a large white flowering crepe myrtle, that's the one, the iconic one.
Mm-hmm. And that's the one I have in my front yard.
Great.
All right. So let's talk about some of that disease resistance and breeding and other things that might be going into the dogwood collection. But let's start off first talking about maybe we'll do it in order of the bloom, starting with Cornus moss, our Carnelian cherry dogwood.
Okay.
So those are tiny yellow blossoms. I think many people wouldn't even recognize it right as a dogwood if they saw it, but it's in the dogwood family, and it's probably one of the first things you're going to see maybe February, March in the DC area in bloom.
Yeah, they really, it is really one of the first ones. And it sort of gets this beautiful haze because the flowers are so small and they're, you know, distributed all around the plant, sort of this sort of haze of yellow on the tree. And it's really nice, you know, when you're, you know, right when you're really, really getting tired of winter, you know, you get this nice blast of color. And the trees are very hardy. And so, you know, they'll be blooming. I mean, even when it's, you know, below freezing, you know, and, you know, the days we get below freezing and then it's a little bit above freezing during the day, the trees will be blooming. And so it's a pretty tough tree. I've tried to put them in gardens, and I've done some gardens for people just to add some really early spring, late winter interest. One of the nice things about Cornus moss, it does have an edible fruit, and if you're lucky enough to get it before the birds or the squirrels get it, they are almost going to be like a tart cherry. And in Eastern Europe, people do make juice and preserves out of it. And we have some trees that, and it's pretty variable. With the ones we have, which are more ornamental, but in Europe, I believe people really often specialize in orchards of the edible ones that have particularly good fruit to you know, to produce you know, whatever the juices or the jams. And I encourage people to try the fruits, you know, when they're out in the garden, you know. And that's a good one. Cornus officinalis too is very similar to Cornus moss. In fact, most people would look at it and they wouldn't be able to quite tell the two apart because the floral structure is really pretty much the same and the leaves are really similar. You know, maybe there's a little bit difference of the leaves on the bottom of the leaf, but that's most people aren't probably going to notice that with the Cornus officinalis. Unfortunately, the fruit of the Cornus officinalis, in my opinion, is inedible. I mean, it's incredibly bitter. And we have one tree. Now, this is amazing. We have one tree in the conifer collection. That's right on the road. And this tree, it was wild collected in Korea, I think in the 80s. And this tree, it really produces an amazing display, floral display. And so we have it. Ours, now ours is, I guess it's just starting to leaf out, but it's been flowering, I say now, for at least 6 to 8 weeks, which is a long time to have, you know, a tree with a lot of color. We've been trying to propagate this tree. And we have not been successful, which is kind of surprising to me that all these years we haven't been able to really get it propagated. So, I mean, we're going to send material out to get it grafted because I think it's nicer than most other Cornus officinalis that are out there. There's only a handful of Cornus officinalis cultivars out there anyway, but this one is exceptional. And there's been some years where the fruit from the year before will still be hanging in the tree when it's blooming. And the combination of having the red fruit and the yellow flowers in a tree is really, really something else. So we've been trying to get that one out, see if we can get that one out to the market.
Yeah, I'm going to have to look out for that one because
Yeah.
I've definitely been concentrating on the Carnelian cherry, the Cornus moss, and not paying attention to that one. And the long flowering sounds wonderful. And then the next in the flowering sequence, of course, is our native dogwoods, the Cornus Florida, that most people would know as the classic dogwood, the white or the pink blooms.
Yeah, the one that they call the flowering dogwood, which I think is kind of funny since they all flower. But yeah, that's our native tree. And so ours, they usually flower, they start flowering the first week in April. This year, it's just a little later than normal. So right now, just right now, they're really just the flowers, and really the what you see that people think is a flower. It's their modified leaves or bracts on the dogwoods, the large flowered dogwoods. So they're just really now, I'd say some trees are about 25%, they're about 25% white, and the rest of them are still sizing up. They're still kind of greenish or greenish yellow. But I have a feeling after the weather we had yesterday and today and next week, they're going to be full on blooming. So that's the one really, and that's the one that really seems to have the most disease problem, unfortunately, for being such a beautiful tree. So, for years. Now, when I first started working here, they was anthracnose was a particularly hitting them particularly hard. And for whatever reason, it seemed like it got less virulent. And right now it's not for us. It's not quite so virulent. And we're sometimes trying to figure out what's going on. Is it genetic recombination or, you know, because I think some of these diseases may reproduce asexually and sexually. And so sometimes you can get a recombination of genes that can make the disease worse or less bad. And I think that's probably one of the things that may be happening. But I mean, anthracnose, it has killed a lot of trees we have had in the garden. One of the things I found that works really well is good air circulation, you know, not have it in too dense of a spot. Mm-hmm. And to have where the tree can get early sunlight, that would help to dry the leaves off, so the moisture is just not on them for too long, and things so like that. Just
early, things like that being, make a difference. Yeah, so early being morning sun.
Morning sun, yes.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Okay, that's great advice. And I was going to ask about some other disease issues that I've been hearing about, especially for in the South. Problems that they're having with dogwoods, and it sounds like powdery mildew and other issues they're having.
Yeah. Now, powdery mildew is one of our worst problems, you know, it really is like, it really looks like a powdery, a dusty thing on the surface of the leaf. And what we found is sometimes in a year when it doesn't rain a lot, it's worse. And someone was telling me that, you know, a lot of times the rain will help to wash the spores off and prevent it, you know, if it comes at the right time and prevent it from becoming too bad. But we sort of had to resort to spraying our trees with a fungicide. Maybe we'll do it 2 or 3 times a year. So after the bloom is all passed and everything like that, you know, we'll spray them. And it really makes a big difference. I mean, I have to say, when we went to North Carolina and we were looking at different people's gardens, you know, I was amazed at how healthy people's dogwoods looked. And I said, well, how come ours don't look like that? You know, and in talking to people, we found that a lot of people spray their dogwoods or have a company come and spray them to keep them nice and healthy, which, you know, that's a lot of work. And so with the new trend has been that they've been breeding disease resistance into them. We're selecting for trees with disease resistance. So one of the best line of these plants is a series from the University of Tennessee, and they all have the name Appalachian in their name. So there's Appalachian Joy, Appalachian Mist, Appalachian Sunrise, Early Sunrise. And what they had done in the beginning is they had grown out like over 1 million seedlings of seeds collected from all over Cornish, Florida. And out of that, in the beginning, I think they were able to select 5 or 6 dogwoods that seemed to have, they just didn't get powdery mildew. You know, it's just genetically they found the one. So those have been propagated like crazy, and they're really on the market. So one of the ones that I think is one of the nicer ones out of the whole series is this one called Jean's Appalachian Snow. And I think a lot of other people think that that's one of the better ones in the group. But that tree, it needs no spraying. I haven't noticed any kind of disease problem with the tree. We've had them in the garden since 2007. So that's a pretty good long run. And I mean, if I grew a dogwood, I would grow one of those for sure, just to save myself the trouble of the disease problem with them. Occasionally, now the amazing thing about it, though, is if you look around, and here at the Arboretum is a good place to do that, there's a lot of dogwoods planted in a lot of places, and especially in the azalea collection. And looking in there a few years ago, I noticed there was a lot of trees that seemed to be really healthy, and they weren't getting any kind of treatment at all. And they might be growing right next to a tree that had terrible powdery mildew. So they're still out there, you know, in the population, trees that if people are observant enough, they can find trees that seem to be pretty healthy and not seem to get the disease. And one thing I often tell people is if you can collect seeds from those trees, I mean, you can propagate them, that's even better. But if you can collect seeds from a population of trees that seems to be pretty healthy and plant them, I think you got a pretty good chance of getting, you know, generate a bunch of seedlings that have resistance, you know, genetic resistance in them. But, you know, you sort of have to be observant about if you're looking at wild population of trees to look for the ones that don't seem to have any evidence of disease on them.
Good to know, because I do hear, you know, a lot of people disappointed that, you know, they think they can't have the native dogwood because of the anthracnose and other issues. So good to know, especially about Jean's Appalachian Snow. I'm going to be on the lookout for that one myself.
Yeah, and you know, one of the other ones too is there's one out there called Appalachian Spring. Now that it sounds like one of the other ones in the Appalachian series, but this was actually found up in the Catoctins near Camp David, and I believe it was when Reagan was president, and he would go out there. And I think at that point, anthracnose was really devastating a lot of native stands of Cornish, Florida, and even Reagan had said, "Why are the trees dying out here?" You know, so he was, you know, he noticed it. But researchers had gone out and had found one tree, you know, in this forest, in this area, in the Catoctins, in this small area. That was the only one that was left. So, you know, they assumed that this plant had genetic resistance to anthracnose, and it was, they propagated it, and it's on the market. It's called Appalachian Spring. And so that's out there. I have to say, though, I have noticed that it may not be 100%, you know, resistant to it, but it, you know, it has that resistance in it. And obviously, what I think some people have been trying to work on, including North Carolina State University, is trying to get a tree with both resistance to powdery mildew and to anthracnose. And that would be a great thing to have a tree that's, you know, so much more healthy than the average dogwood tree out there. So we're still waiting, North Carolina State.
I know. I do know that they're busy on that. And I was going to drop some fun facts about flowering dogwood or Cornus florida. It's the state tree of Virginia and Missouri. I think that was the tree we sent to Japan. I think it was, what, 3,000 dogwood
Oh, yes,
seedlings?
several years ago, the Arboretum sent them sort of as a thank you gift for sending us all those cherries, those beautiful cherries that people admire here in the springtime in Washington. So it's a nice reciprocal gift.
And I
Very
think
nice.
one of the most unique, and I would say one of my favorite dogwoods that I've seen is it's a subspecies, variegated Urbiana, if I'm saying it correctly. It's the Mexican dogwood.
Yeah, that's Cornish, Florida variety Urbaniana. And so, yeah, and you know, it's funny because I didn't know anything about this tree before I started working here. But when I first started working in the dogwood collection, the first thing they wanted me to do was to try to propagate that tree. And so they had two selections of wild collected. And that tree is actually from northern Mexico. So it's in a spot in Mexico, it's in the place, the furthest south place in North America that Cornus Florida grows. So in that place, they actually found these trees where the flowers don't really open up completely. They're still closed at the top, so it looks kind of like a something like a Chinese lantern or something like that. They're very unique. I mean, it's really kind of wild looking, and so I kind of got real obsessed with that tree also. And what we and one thing that we had is and so we propagated lots of them. We're trying to get them out to people. We're trying to send them to other nurseries so they can sell it to people also. But we collected seed from the tree in the garden, and I grew them out, and this was like 2005. So we got four selections out of that, and three of those are growing here at the Arboretum. And so they're a little bit different. One of them has gold leaves, which is kind of unique. And the other ones, they have the disease resistance. They have, and so one of the things also that this variety Urbaniana, it has powdery mildew resistance in it, and so it doesn't ever seem to get powdery mildew. So, you know, I was thinking that would be something good in a breeding program. But the thing is, the flowers, you know, and after many, many generations of growing them, the one thing I noticed is that trait of the flowers staying closed is very strong. And you know, almost every offspring out of any crosses or selected seeds out of that, they all have that unique flower form, that is the untraditional flower form. So a lot of people like it because it's so unique. But I try not to have too many in the garden because it's kind of different, you know, from your typical dogwood form. But some of the seedlings we selected, they have the bracts are wider than the wild species, and I think it gives it a more ornamental look. So people want to come to the garden, you know, right in the middle of the garden there's a large tree of one of these Urbaniana seedlings or offspring that's growing there, and it's very, very vigorous and super floriferous. And there's also another one in the flowering tree collection we have here at the Arboretum also. So if people want to come, the flowers are just, they're just reaching full size just about now and over maybe the next week. So people want to come to the garden, I'd be happy to show it to them.
So early to mid-April for that one. And it's hard to describe in words, but you picture that open dogwood flower, that cross, with the open bracts, but that the tips of them are still connected and touching. So there's just still connected bracts around it, which does, as you say, look like a little lantern, or it looks like a little open, almost like a wonton, George, I'm gonna say.
Oh,
Yeah,
I
like a
never thought of it like
wonton
that.
wrapper. Yeah, to me it looks like it's got to have a food analogy. But yeah, it does look, and it's so unique, and it is so gorgeous. So let's move on to the Cornus kusa. And so that's Chinese dogwood, sometimes referred to as Korean dogwood, and that collection. And those bloom a little bit later, but I think a lot of people are growing the kusa for the leaf, not necessarily for the flower.
Well, they're really pretty plants. They're sort of, well, I'll say, okay, so within that whole group, so the kusas, yeah, they're from primarily from Eastern Asia. And it's surprising, how much some of the plants in Eastern Asia resemble the plants in Eastern North America. Especially after working in the Asian collection, I really noticed that there's this relationship, and then, for whatever reason, with all the history of geological stuff on the planet. But so the kusas are really tough plants. The one thing that's really nice, that they're very tough. They don't really get the disease. They seem to be resistant to the diseases like powdery mildew and anthracnose. And so, the trees are a lot less trouble. I have to say, they're more vigorous and tend to get larger and live for a longer period of time. We have one in the garden, so that was planted. That was acquired in 1952 and planted. And the canopy, I measured the canopy at the base a few years ago, and it was 40 feet across, which is it's really big. And then when the tree flowers well, it's so covered with flowers. You almost can't see the leaves or the structure. You just see this tremendous amount of white. And they're really fantastic. I mean, I think it's one of an excellent tree. And so there's the with that group, there's in Korea and Japan and whatnot in China. They're all very similar, but people think really the Chinese form is the better form, and most of the ones you see on the market that have been developed in the last X number of years are primarily the Chinese form. And so that plant, you have purple, and with that within that family also you have, the majority of them are white flowered, but there's pink flowered forms also. There's one variety called Benny Fuji, which for a long time was the best, like pink and just beautiful plant. A few years ago, Rutgers University, with the assistance of let me see, a researcher, I think his name was Philip Waddle from the USDA, helped them develop, and they did these crosses using Benny Fuji and I guess some unnamed other kusas. And they have developed a new kusa that came out, I believe, in 2015 that's called Scarlet Fire. And Scarlet Fire has amazingly dark, very saturated colored petals, or bracts, I should say, pardon me, bracts. It's really a nice tree. And it's fantastic. I gotta say, it's a fantastic tree. So, we have two of those in the garden, and I've seen them in a lot of places. We went out, we saw it in Oregon, actually, at a nursery, and I was surprised. That was the first place I saw one fully grown and in flower. In 2019, we saw one out there, and the tree is just fantastic. I mean, if I got us, and I don't know if they get as big as the other ones. We have some that here that I have to say, they're just huge. They may be 40 feet tall, which is kind of out of scale for, some people's gardens. But there are some varieties that people have noticed to grow smaller than that. But it will take the tree a long time to get to that size. But there are smaller forms of Cornus kusa. If you look in some catalogs, they may be described as being more narrow or slower growing. There's one called Snow Tower, which is it doesn't get very wide. So that's good for smaller spaces. We have one of those in the garden also. So one of the other things though that has happened is that Rutgers University also did these crosses, and they've done it a couple. They've come out with many, many plants that are combination that's a cross between Cornus florida and Cornus kusa, and some of them are just they're fantastic, and they bloom right in between the time of the Cornus florida and the Cornus kusa. So if you have the Florida, the hybrid, the Rutgers hybrids, and kusa in your garden, you can have this unbroken, a display for a long time. One of the things that we did in the garden, and there's a lot of them, and they have quite a few varieties out of the Rutgers group. One of the things we also found is there's a couple other groups of dogwoods that bloom even later. There's another one that we have that's called Well, it was found in England, so it was accidentally found in the garden where they had Cornus cusa and Cornus capitata, which is a Himalayan dogwood. And this tree blooms quite late. I'd say it probably blooms in like May, June. So this is real late for dogwood, and it's really blooms heavily. Most people think the tree is not really adaptable to our area, but we've had one in the garden for 20-something years, and it's doing great. And then there's another form. There's another type of dogwood that's called Cornus elliptica, which is evergreen dogwood, and that tree will be blooming on July 4th, which is
Wow.
just amazing. So you could have large bracted dogwoods going all the way from the first week in April to July. And I think it's pretty amazing to have, dogwoods consistently, big showy dogwoods for that long. So we have those. We try to have all of those in the garden so people can really see, how to really, get as long of a display as possible and, what the varieties are that are available out there.
And I'm in particular a fan of Cornus wolf eyes for that beautiful foliage. So I have one of those in my garden, and it stayed pretty small. I'm going to say it's still under about a 6 foot tree after several years.
I think it's more, it really seems to be more like a large shrub. It doesn't really seem to take on the stature of a tree, a tree thing. It seems to be like a large shrub, but it is beautiful. I have to admit, I love the color of it. And the flowers even have a little touch of the variegation where I think it has a green edge around the flower or something, a slight light green edge around the flower, which makes it super, super showy.
Especially in a shade garden, it is, stunning. In a small city or urban sized lot, it's just I would say it was the perfect little tree to have, even in a container. So let's move on to dogwood care and some tips for growing dogwoods. So our first would be your best planting tips. So maybe soil preparation. Do we want to plant it a little high in the hole? What type of soils do you think they prefer?
Well, here we just a lot of stuff we have here. We don't modify our soil too much here at the RV. I mean, the soil in the dogwood collection, I say it's pretty good. It's kind of like a forest area. It was a forested area, so the soil is pretty nice. We don't really add a tremendous amount of amendments to the soil because I think what we found is sometimes if you just plant it in the native soil, if the soil is decent, it will do well. And then maintaining a mulch layer around the tree to sort of help to keep the roots cool and provide, a lot of organic matter with the breakdown of the mulch, it seems to really work pretty well for us. We do better to make sure that we plant the tree like when you plant it, that it's a tiny bit high, so it's the root flare is above ground, and we don't comprom try that's one of the important things, try not to compromise that. But also when you're planting it, if you have one, if you take it out of the pot and the roots seem to be very congested, or even starting to wrap around, you definitely have to loosen it up. And sometimes you can be a little rough with the plant, but it's much better in the long run that the roots don't encircle themselves, and often the tree can choke itself, which I never thought it could really happen, but I've seen now that I've been working here a lot of trees poorly planted over the years that it's compromised the longevity of the tree by having roots that girdle, that tend to choke themselves. So we try to make sure the roots are going out, tease them out. And sometimes, if it's really bad, like take a knife, a soil knife or something like that, and score down the root ball and cutting those encircling roots so they just stop wrapping around, and try to tease them out before planting. And that one of the tips in general for a lot of trees, that's when we talk about, we see trees that fail here. One of the things we notice is just improper planting techniques have happened. And any of us can be guilty of it, but we try to strive to, when we're doing this, to do it the right way and make sure the tree gets off to the best start possible. And with the mulch too, and we don't fertilize. We don't use any fertilizer in the garden, so we don't fertilize any of our trees at all. They just grow with the natural with nutrients that are in the soil, which always seems, sufficient. And just try to maintain when the tree's maybe out in the open or something like that, or in a place where there's going to be competition from other plants, that we actually mulch it to eliminate that competition and keep the root ball moist, somewhat moist and cool. And Cornus floridus do not like to get dry. They can handle it. They don't like wet, but you certainly should try to make sure that the soil doesn't ever dry out totally around them. Last year, we had a short drought in the end of summer, and we had a couple trees. And, you know, we thought we were watering enough, but there was a couple trees where all the leaves turned brown.
Oh,
it was just really shocking. And I thought, I'm looking to see if the trees are going to come back. But we got into a very severe dry period for just a small amount of time last fall. And it was, for some trees, it was too much. And trees that had been established, which it really amazed me, you know, a tree that had been in the ground for 20 years went through that kind of, you know, that kind of a shock. Hmm. So it's important not to ever let them dry out totally.
Good to note on and that's the native dogwood in particular.
In general, but that tree that I'm talking about, that was a coosa, which I thought, I was shocked. You know, it looked like a tree full of potato chips when I actually saw it. And so I was really surprised, you know, and the tree looks healthy. It looks like it's going to come back, but I've never seen a dogwood tree do that. You know, completely turned brown. Usually what will happen sometimes, you'll see browning on the leaves and that'll be or the leaves will be flagging. And that's when you need to get the hose out and, you know, get the soil moist again to keep the tree happy. And one year we did plant sometimes if we plant a little, like in the spring, we have to be really cautious that we don't let the tree go through too much moisture stress, because the summertime around here can be pretty tough on trees. And I've seen where we had a tree like that, that was planted, like let's say in May or so, or June, and we had to plant it. We planted it as a dedication for a staff member that passed away. And so it was really imperative that we stayed on the case and make sure that, you know, the tree never dried out, because the tree that was next to it, while it was establishing a few years before that, had gone through some of this dry stuff, and really the leaves turned brown and they crisped up. Mm-hmm. And even though the stems and everything were healthy, the tree kind of defoliated early. And so it's important to watch your moisture on when we get into a dry spell around here.
Yeah, I notice some of those sometimes with the crispy edges. And sometimes I think it's because they're sited in too much sun, and that maybe some dogwoods prefer to be in morning sun, afternoon shade, and more of an understory tree.
Yeah, and it really is an understory tree. I mean, in nature, you probably really won't see one growing out in the open. And it's tough sometimes establishing a tree in the open until they actually get, you know, get a good, decent root system and, you know, get taken care of pretty well.
And so you're not doing any fertilizing. You're putting wood chips around as mulch, I'm assuming. And then what type of pruning are you doing, if any?
Well, one thing we do is try to get the structural pruning to try to make sure the trees don't have branches growing the wrong way, growing internally or, you know, crossing or things like that. So especially it's really important when the tree is young to really start kind of training it. So one thing that, you know, we try to do that with all the trees when we get them in the ground is try to, you know, assess the look of the tree and, you know, try to see if we have to do any kind of corrective pruning with it. Now, all the pruning, one of the problems that dogwoods have that people don't talk about too much is dogwood borer, which can kill dogwood trees. And had a lot of trees in the collection had died. And I think a lot of that happens because the dogwood borer is active. It's a small insect. I think it may be a clear-wing moth. So people don't even know what it looks like. You don't even hardly ever see it. But they're attracted to the smell, I believe, when you do a big cut on a tree and, you know, there's an odor that comes out and the insect is attracted to that scent. So we don't do any major pruning during the warm season. I'm not doing any major pruning now, from now on until late fall again, or fall. And doing it that way, I think we pretty much don't have any borer problems in the garden, knock on wood. But when I first started working there, I noticed there was a lot of trees that had that. And I think that people weren't following the, when to prune and when not to prune guidelines. And by doing, you know, major cuts or structural cuts in the summertime, often the insects would come and, you know, they'd lay the eggs and the larvae would get in the tree and the tree was doomed. So, we'll remove like some dead wood in the summertime, you know, during the growing season. If we see something like that or a dead branch that's completely dead or something like that, we'll go ahead and take that out. But any kind of structural pruning with live wood, we just keep that in the cooler months of the year. And, you know, that's kind of just the hard, fast rule that I tell everybody, you know, that's thinking about taking care of their dogwoods, is I tell them, don't make any major cuts in the summertime and your tree will probably be a lot happier.
Good advice. So I have to ask the four-letter word, George, and that's deer. What do you do about deer at the Arboretum?
Well, aside from saying bad things about them, we cage our trees. So once it really the and I've seen this happen when we were planting trees, and we said, "Well, we'll cage it tomorrow," and you come out and the tree had been that da was damaged overnight. So the deer seem to be real interested in anything new in their environment, and we have a pretty sizable deer population because we have so many woods here, and we're right next to the river. So we cage our trees, and generally speaking, leave the cages on until the tree gets a reasonable size trunk that can take some degree of messing around with. But the important time is really in the rutting season in the fall, when the male deer are out there, rubbing their antlers on stuff. And that's really destructive of trees. I've seen where trees, young trees, were completely broken. They just rub the tree until they broke it, and then snap the tree over. And a tree could have been a couple years old, but the deer was enthusiastic enough to do it. So we keep them caged until they get to a good size. And I have to say, a lot of the trees, what during the pandemic, everything kind of fell apart. And so a lot of the trees that had been caged in that fall, we left the cages on them. And so we have noticed, I mean, I have to say, I've left a lot of cages around trees that are still younger, just to make sure that we don't lose, like something doesn't happen to the tree until I'd say the trunk gets at least 2 inches, 2 inches across. Any smaller than that, I think the tree is really pretty sensitive to deer messing with it. We don't have much browsing damage, though, fortunately. So it's pretty much just the rut and the male deer being aggressive.
Good to know. And yes, and then remove that caging as the tree grows. You don't want to leave that on
Yeah.
forever.
Once the tree gets too big, if you have it on there too long, the branches get inside of the fencing and the caging, and it really becomes a nightmare. So, either that, or regularly go through and make sure the branches are not going through, like just pull them back through and have them growing more upright and not outward. And but a lot of the trees in the garden we have right now have cages on them, and I have sort of I have to say I've left a lot of the cages on year round on some of the trees when we have particularly heavy years with heavy deer population. And sometimes we have a lot of deer here because there's a lot of good stuff to eat. And we've even seen them swimming. People have actually told me, I haven't seen this, but people have told me they've seen deer swimming across the Anacostia from Kenilworth Gardens to the Arboretum.
I
And
can
that's like, really,
imagine.
deer swim?
I could see them doing that back and forth for just the select items, the
Oh, yeah. They
good
said, "Hey, we're going to have Chinese tonight, or we're going to have dogwoods tonight," or something like that. So
ones.
it is a constant thing for us. To our deer pressure is a constant concern. And the USDA does help by sending some of their people out here to control the deer, keep the deer population down. And we have the place, they have the Arboretum has a fence all around it. But one of the problems we have is trees tend to fall on it in places where we're not always looking at the fence. And when that happens, the deer just come right in. They just come right in. And often they eat so well that they have twins and triplets. And so there's not a lot of mouths to feed. So we definitely try to keep our fences repaired whenever we can. And fortunately, the government had provided money after 9/11 to secure or put fences around a lot of government facilities. So we took that money and definitely extended the fence all around the place to try to protect it as much from deer coming from the outside as possible.
Yeah, and I know that's a constant vigilance. So, George, in our last few minutes together, any final advice for those who want to grow dogwoods in the mid-Atlantic? Anything we haven't mentioned yet so far?
Well, I'd say the first thing is get a tree that is not going to have a problem. So if I went out and got a dogwood tree, and they look so similar anyway, so why not get a healthy variety of Cornish Florida? So there's all of the Appalachian series is out there. I would suggest people if they're going to get new dogwoods, to get ones that you're not going to have a problem with. Siting is pretty important. So not putting them in a place where it's exposed to hot sun all day. That's tough on them. We have a lot of dogwoods that are growing in full sunlight, but we have to make a point of making sure that they're in a moist spot that doesn't dry out. And maybe have some overstory, some larger trees nearby to cast a little bit of shade on them if possible. And they really appreciate that in the hot part of the summer because they really are understory trees. So the selection, the right cultivar, that's always important. Correct planting. Like I said, get it in good soil, soil that drains well, like what everybody wants, moist, well-drained soil. That's the gardener's ideal. So, you know, have a good soil for it. Maintain a mulch cover on it. We often try to like extend the mulch out about 3 feet, but keep it away from the trunk and no more than a few inches thick. Some people just overdo it with mulch and that's going to be very detrimental. So we try to just mulch a bit, you know, a couple inches, 1 or 2 inches, and about maybe 3 feet out and a couple inches, at least a couple inches away from the trunk so that the decomposing mulch doesn't encourage, you know, rot on the base of the tree. Mm-hmm. And that, I'd say that's pretty much the advice I would give somebody if they're really trying to, you know, successfully grow Cornus Florida. Now, these other trees, Icusa, is much tougher. It's a lot easier. And some of the other varieties, well, let me see those. That the hybrids from Rutgers University, they're super vigorous. Those are great trees. I mean, I can't say enough good things about the Rutgers series of trees. And, you know, the Elliptica. Now, the Elliptica, too, there's a variety out there on the market that's called the Empress of China that is very popular. And that tree is fairly fairly sun tolerant and blooms very heavily, you know, and like I said, in June and July. So that's really a great tree for people, you know, if they want to have a later bloom in their garden or extend the bloom as long as possible. And that one, unfortunately, we have had a really nice one in the garden. A huge oak tree fell last week, and I think it may have destroyed our Empress of China. But we have some other Cornus Elliptica that we're growing out that's from seeds that were collected in China in years, prior years by the Arboretum or other botanical garden staff. And, you know, a lot of times we do that, they'll do that and we'll share seeds with different institutions. So we have some like that, that are the Cornus Elliptica that just is unnamed variety, but it grows exceptionally well too. So we're trying to grow a bunch of those out and, you know, see if we can get some of our selections, if they're any better than the Empress of China. I've been trying to figure out if ours is better than theirs. They seem to be very similar. So I say if people can get a hold of Empress of China, that's a great tree also.
Great advice, George. And how can listeners follow up or contact you?
Well, they can contact me at my email here at the Arboretum, which is george.waters@usda.com. I mean, .gov, pardon me, .gov. Mm-hmm. Or they can come to the Dogwood Collection to see the dogwoods blooming. And they can talk to me there. Mm-hmm. And see the thing really happening right there.
And just catch you in the garden.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much, George. This has been a wonderful education all about dogwoods, and glad that you were able to share your passion for that tree family with us. And we'll definitely have to have you back just to talk about the Gotelli collection in itself as well. Thank you so much, George.
My pleasure.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Loropetalum plant profile. Loropetalum, Loropetalum chinense, is also known as Chinese fringe flower. It is a member of the witch hazel family and is native to China, Japan, and the Himalayas. It is a common ornamental plant throughout the southeastern United States, and it's starting to be seen more frequently in the mid-Atlantic region. They are hardy to USDA zones 7 to 10. It blooms in early spring with masses of white or purple-pink frilly flowers with a smattering of reblooming throughout the rest of the growing season. Loropetalum is an evergreen shrub that can grow from 10 to 15 feet high and wide. There are also dwarf cultivars available. It can be pruned to control the size, but it's better to plant it in a spot where it can attain its natural shape and form. They are often used as hedges, topiaries, or limbed up to form small trees. Plant them in full to part sun locations with moist, well-drained, acidic soil, and add plenty of organic matter. mulch around them well. You can add a slow-release fertilizer in spring, if you wish. Laura Petalum, you can grow that. What's new in the garden this week? Well, I've been enjoying the scents of my lilacs in bloom. The summer snowflakes or Leucogium and the dwarf iris are also blooming, and I've been cutting some bouquets to enjoy inside. Over at the community garden plot, we have seedlings of radishes, arugula, spinach, and even our peas are starting to show up as well. In our garden tip of the day that we share on our social media, tips included to keep your fertilizer applications 10 to 15 feet away from any waterways and to not apply fertilizer if a heavy rain is predicted. In local gardening events, some that you might want to attend include Mount Cuba's Wildflower Weekend, and that is April 19th through 21st, a Friday through Sunday. Free for members and included with general admission. You can get your time tickets online at mountcuba.org. The Maryland Native Plant Society is hosting a online program using iNaturalist to document plant diversity by Deborah Barber, and that's on April 23rd at 7 p.m. It is free and open to the public, and you can register for it at mdflora.org. On Saturday, April 20th, from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m., is the annual spring celebration at Glen Carlin Library Demonstration Garden in Northern Virginia in Arlington. And you can find out about that from glencarlinlibrarygarden@gmail.com. And that is an Earth Day and Arbor Day celebration both this year. It includes kids' activities, a large variety of plants, and nature-related items for sale as well. And speaking of plant sales, the Northern Virginia chapter of the Azalea Society of America is having two azalea sales coming up at Meadowlark Botanical Gardens in Vienna, Virginia. Those are on April 27th and May 4th. From 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. The rain dates are April 28th and May 5th if needed. And then finally, the Delaware Center for Horticulture is having its Dig It, a Rare Plant Auction on April 27th from 6:30 p.m. to 9:30 p.m. in Wilmington, Delaware. And they are having celebrated plant expert and friend of the podcast, David Culp, as their special guest. This year's spring fundraiser is in support of DCH's programs to help develop public education and community outreach, and you can register for that at thedch.org. Happy gardening!
In the new book, The Urban Garden, by Kathy Jensen Terry Spate, you'll find dozens of inspiring and creative ways to grow flowers, shrubs, vegetables, herbs, and other plants in small spaces and with a limited budget. Whether you want to grow on a balcony, rooftop, front stoop, or a tiny urban patio, turn your growing dreams into reality and build a gorgeous and unique garden that showcases your personal style while still being functional and productive. With the ingenious ideas and resourceful tactics found here, you'll be maximizing yields and beauty from every square inch of your space while also making a lush outdoor living area you'll crave spending time in. Whether you're growing edible plants or beautiful flowers, the 101 amazing growing ideas found in The Urban Garden will turn your tiny urban yard into a treasure trove of green you'll be proud to share with family and friends. Buy your copy today at your local retail bookseller or order it online now at amazon.com or bookshop.org. Get low-maintenance alternative salons with the new book Ground Cover Revolution by Kathy Jentz. Reducing the lawn is among the biggest trends in home ownership, with an endless stream of homeowners looking for an eco-friendly alternative to a traditional everyday grass lawn. In the last few years alone, over 23 million American adults converted part of the lawn to a natural landscape and now are looking to do even more. The biggest challenge to adopting this new ideal of the perfect lawn is knowing how and when to replace your turf and which plants are the best ones for the job. Ground Cover Revolution is here with all the answers you need. Included are 40 in-depth profiles of plants that are perfect choices for replacing a grass lawn. There are options for sun, for shade, for dry and wet sites, and for various climates around the globe. There are choices that bloom, options that are evergreen, and selections that are deer-resistant. Author Kathy Jentz has also included an incredibly useful chart that gives you all the details on each of the 40 choices for quick reference and to make your ground cover selection process even easier. Whether you want to replace the entire lawn or just reduce the amount of land dedicated to turf, Ground Cover Revolution will help you usher in a new and improved idea of what a beautiful lawn should be. Available at bookstores now and also at Quarto.com, where you can get 30% off using discount code GARDENING30.
This is The Last Word by Christy Page with Food Gardening Network on stocking my local nursery. Is it spring yet? We just had a few really warm days. We hit 60 degrees and spring was definitely in the air. I didn't mind taking the dogs out and stood basking in the sun while their noses twitched in the air. They were smelling what I was feeling, the basking glow of spring. These few days caused a level of excitement in me that I cannot really describe. I immediately started looking at new raised bed gardens online. I started reading about the best times to plant specific vegetables for optimal harvest. And I even pulled out pen and paper and started to make a list of things that I'm going to need to get this year. At the top of my list is a new fruit tree. While Penelope the peach tree seems to be doing better, she's not 100%. I have come to the decision that she definitely needs a friend. This year, we will be shopping for another peach tree and maybe even two apple trees. I eagerly went to the website and Facebook pages of my local nursery. There was nothing new on the website, and their Facebook page still had their "See you in the spring" message pinned. Didn't they know that spring is here? Didn't they feel the warmth of that 60-degree day? Forlorn, I started scrolling through posts and images from last year. There were the fruit trees that I'm longing for. Oh, but look at that. They had some gorgeous dahlias last year. Those would be beautiful up by the mailbox. And look at those lilac bushes. I can smell them already. I think my trip might require a bigger truck and more than just a couple of trees. I glanced at the clock and noted that an hour had passed. I just spent an hour cyberstalking a nursery. And they're not even open for the season yet, but I'm already impatiently waiting for new pictures to peruse. Today is a reminder that it's not quite spring. The temperature has dropped to 30 degrees and the wind is biting. Maybe my local nursery knows better than me and is waiting for more than one fair weather day before shouting, "It's spring!" from the rooftops. It looks like I have a little more time to wait before going to pick out my new blooms. In the meantime, though, maybe I will just feel warmer by looking at the pictures from last year. It can't hurt. This has been The Last Word by Christy Page with foodgardening.com.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Thank you for listening to Garden DC. You can become a listener supporter for as little as 99 cents a month by going to anchor.fm/gardendc/support. Another way to support this podcast is to subscribe to our monthly digital publication, Washington Gardener Magazine. To do so, go to washingtongardener.com. Thank you. Thank you for listening to Garden DC. You can become a listener supporter for as little as 99 cents a month by going to podcasters.spotify.com/pod/show/GardenDC. Another way to support this podcast is to subscribe to our monthly digital publication, Washington Gardener Magazine. To do so, go to washingtongardener.blogspot.com. Thank you. You can find and follow Washington Gardener on Twitter/X, Instagram, and Pinterest at WDC Gardener, and on Facebook at Washington Gardener Magazine. Please take a moment to rate and review this podcast on Spotify and Apple. Open the Spotify or Apple app, search for Garden DC, check on the rate button, and select 5 stars.